Okay, so today is May 7th, 2014. This is an oral history interview with Michael Rosen. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Michael, to help me with sound quality on my end, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Michael Rosen, and the last name is spelled R-O-S-E-N.
Thank you. Michael, when did you come to UW-Madison as a student?
I was at Madison from 1966 to 70.
Okay. So this will allow you, if you want, to talk a little bit about your sort of pre-UW-Madison background, but basically the question is, you know, why matriculate to Madison at that time?
Okay. I actually spent most of my younger life in New Hampshire, but both of my parents had gone to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I was kind of raised as a badger, if you will. My father was from Baltimore, and he went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He graduated in 1941, immediately went to the officer training program at the North Lakes Training Center and shipped out. My mother, whom he met at Madison, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, she met him there. They got married right before he shipped out, and as we grew up, we were always pointed towards the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
So
it was kind of natural for me to go there.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying there, even if there would have been other choices to go to college, Madison sort of bubbled to the top?
Madison was the top choice. I even remember watching the 1961 Rose Bowl game with my father, with Ron Vanderkellen. I mean, we were University of Wisconsin Badger fans, and it was where I wanted to go.
Okay. So when you got here, did you start off in the dorms?
Yeah, Og Hall, sixth floor.
Did you say Og Hall?
Yes.
Okay.
Which has now been, as I understand it, obliterated.
It's not what you remember it as, that's for sure.
You know, at that time it was an all-male dormitory.
Had you... Growing up in New Hampshire, had you been to Madison before you matriculated here?
I had not been to Madison before.
Could you maybe, or if you remember, some of your thoughts, your initial thoughts about the city and campus when you got here?
Actually, we drove from New Hampshire, and I remember driving through Northeast Indiana and Chicago, and for the first time in my life seeing huge belching factories and steel mills. We were on the interstate, but at that time the steel industry was still booming, and there were flames coming out of the smokestacks, and that's probably the most memorable thing I remember of the trip. In fact, that's the only thing I remember about the trip. When I got to Madison, I think what impressed me was the size of it. The University of New Hampshire was a school of probably 8,000. And just to think about it, we went to the football field, the University of Camp Randall, which was huge compared to college football fields that I'd seen in New England, and I'd seen several of them. I'd seen the one at Dartmouth. I'd seen the one at the University of New Hampshire, the one at the University of Vermont, and they were, you know, very small in comparison. And, you know, really, I mean, I guess you would say Wisconsin was big time, and they weren't. But it was the size of the campus, I think, that impressed me the most.
Okay, thank you.
And for me, growing up in New Hampshire, Madison was a bigger city than the kind of town I'd grown up in.
Okay. So, had you had any involvement in in politics or student activism growing up in New Hampshire?
Yeah, I was elected the president of my class my junior year, and that year I think was the year that Khrushchev was coming to the United States, and the New Hampshire legislature, which was extremely reactionary. New Hampshire was a very, very Republican state, but it was extremely reactionary. It had they had passed a resolution or a law, I'm not sure which it was, saying that Khrushchev could not be on state property in New Hampshire. And I helped organize with others a number of the student councils in the high schools, I believe it was about 13, to say how ridiculous this was. If he was visiting the state and he had to go to the bathroom, we were going to deny him the right to go to the bathroom. I think that was the example that we used. So I was involved in that. And when I was, it might have been that year or maybe the year before, I was an athlete. I was a captain. My senior year, I was captain of both the soccer team and the baseball team. But either in my sophomore or junior year, we were coming, I think it was my junior year, we were coming home from practice, and there was all this, and we passed the University of New Hampshire, and there was all this commotion going on. And so we went up to the Memorial Union to see what was going on. There was a hill, kind of, and the Union was at the top. And there was, I don't know, 1,000 students screaming at 16 pacifists who were having a silent vigil against the war in Vietnam. And, you know, my interest at that point, I had just gone up there out of kind of interest to see what was going on. Well, my younger brother, who was 6 years younger than me, Mark, came walking up with a sign that our cousins from New York City had given us that said, "Bring the troops home now." And he came walking into the crowd, and a couple college students jumped him. And so I jumped in to protect my brother, really. It wasn't so much a political motivation, but to protect my brother. And I got freed my brother. I don't remember if we got the sign or not, but I was so angry, I went down and stood with the pacifists. And then they essentially got run out of town. And rocks were being thrown or eggs, I don't recall exactly. And so as they were running, I mean, if you went, the Memorial Union Street was the same street as the main street in this very small town, Durham, New Hampshire. And as we kind of ran down the street, I don't know where they went, but since I was a townie, I ducked into the Grants, which was a local drugstore, soda bar, and which was owned by a friend of mine, his father, and, you know, got out of trouble. But I was very disturbed by that, feeling like, who are these students to run me out of my own hometown? So that was kind of probably my first political experience.
Yeah. So getting here to Madison then, I guess reflecting upon it, did you have any inklings initially in becoming involved in any sort of student government or student activism?
Not really, but I was, you know, I had read in high school, I had read Rampart's magazine, and I do remember when I read a number of books like Black Like Me, Richard Wright's, I can't even think of the name of it now. But
in, was Wright Invisible Man?
No. I read that in college. Okay. That was Ellison.
Oh, right, right.
But Richard Wright's book about the guy that ends up killing a black guy from the South who's in the North, and he ends up killing a wealthy white kind of paternalistic woman.
Native Son?
Native Son. At the school we went to growing up in New Hampshire, it was heavily Anglo-Saxon Protestant. In fact, I was the only Jewish kid in my high school, and there was one black family. And, you know, I was fairly sensitized to racial discrimination and ethnic discrimination, both as a victim of it in some cases, and also observing how and feeling that the black kid, the couple of black children that were in my class were mistreated. And I'd read Ramparts about the war in Vietnam. I don't know that I went to Madison. I don't think it was part of my thinking to go to Madison to be an activist, but and I don't remember exactly how I got started getting involved. I do remember going to one meeting of one of the groups around the war when I was a freshman, and them asking me to run for treasurer right away, which I thought was really strange, because you know, I mean, I guess, why would you ask someone you don't really know to handle the money of your organization? And I didn't get involved with that group. In fact, I don't think I got involved with any organizations my freshman year.
Okay. So, Michael, just to make sure I heard you correctly, so where you grow up, you felt akin to the African American, the one African American family.
Yeah, I what I would say is, I had some experiences growing up in a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant community. For example, when I was in the Cub Scouts, and one of the things you had to say was you're obedient, loyal, reverent. And I was uncomfortable. I went home and I told my parents, I'm uncomfortable saying I'm reverent, because there's, you know, we didn't go to any church, or, and that's what it meant to me. And it made, you know, that you knew you were different. Or when I was 13, another Jewish family had a bris, and I had to participate. Maybe I was 13 or 14. I had to participate as an adult because there weren't enough Jewish men in the community so they had to draft me. And so I had, you know, I had some experience. And, actually, in eighth grade, I ended up in a fist fight with someone who really was my best friend, who was calling me Jew girl at school. So there were experiences like that I think sensitized me to discrimination. And I think also I had been raised by a father who enlisted in World War II to fight fascism. I had two aunts who were Holocaust survivors. And I think that that upbringing, certainly I was raised with an understanding that there was discrimination in the world, and that it was the responsibility of moral people to oppose that discrimination when they witnessed it.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that for me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So I guess, if you don't mind, then you said you weren't involved that much your freshman year.
No, I wasn't.
What What sort of classes were you taking your freshman year?
The only one I really remember is the European Social History with George Mossy. And I think that was the first semester of my freshman year, and somehow I got selected for the honors section, which meant that he was my TA. And I have very fond memories of that. We would meet with Mossy once a week. He was an outstanding and interesting person.
Yeah, that's a unique and probably really valuable experience to be able to, he was such well-known and well-regarded on campus.
Yeah, and he was a great teacher, and he was interested in his students, at least. We developed a relationship. I actually even drove to Milwaukee with him one time, but it was actually the year of the Black Student Strike. It was not when he was speaking at some Jewish community event, and I don't really remember exactly why I was driving with him up there, over there rather.
Okay.
But I do remember some of the conversation that we had, because I remember discussing with him the Black Student Strike. I considered him somewhat of a mentor when I was a student.
Okay. So, Michael, were you intending to major in history when you got here, or did you just...
I don't think I knew what I was going to major in.
Okay.
And I'm not sure why I ended up taking that course. Maybe someone told me he was a great teacher and I should take it. I have no idea.
Do you recall that first year, some of the places that you would hang out, either to, get a bite to eat or just be with friends?
I generally ate at the in the dining hall connected with Og, but the Broad House was a place that we went to frequently. Obviously, the Ratskeller, especially when the weather was nice and you could be outside. And I recall, and I don't recall the name, but there was some kind of jazz club up on State Street, that we went to as well.
Okay. Did you stay in Madison that first summer?
No, I never stayed in. I never was able to stay in Madison for the summer.
So did you go back, just went back home, or?
Yeah, I went back home.
Okay. So,
I didn't go back home every summer, but that summer I did go back home.
Okay, thank you. So that next year then starts off fairly soon after that, in that fall semester with the Dow riot.
Right. And I was at the Dow riot, but I was not in the building.
Okay.
But a close friend of mine was. I was outside. I actually went inside to try to get my friend. I had attended some of the... There were SDS meetings that took place prior to that, and I had attended some of the meetings, but I wasn't... And I was getting politically active. I suppose could say I was a member of SDS, although I don't think I ever signed a card or became a... But I attended those meetings, several of the meetings that they had. I wasn't committed to that action or event, but one of my friends, a guy named Billy Drew, who I think is a year older than me, was a year ahead of me, he was, and so he was inside. So I did go inside when to try to find him and help him. But so I was right there when it happened, but I was not a participating in the sit-in.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall your personal feelings or emotions when it started?
I think mine was very similar to a lot of the students, which was outrage at the police behavior, and that the police were brought in to beat up or arrest students. Rather, I think at the time the police were not trained they certainly weren't trained in crowd control, or I hate to use the word riot control because it wasn't a riot, but they weren't trained in that. And so I was outraged by them wading in, and you know, they were hitting people and arresting people and grabbing people. It was chaos, as I recall, and like literally thousands of students. I was upset by that.
So you had said that you had attended some SDS meetings before. Do you remember, was that when you got back your sophomore year? Did you actually start to attend some?
Yeah. I think my freshman year, I started to, I guess this was after that. There was a group called the Wisconsin Draft Resistance Union also. Mm-hmm. I think that organized a year late after SDS and Dow.
Yeah. Okay. But you were, just to confirm, you were, at least in your memory, attending SDS meetings before the Dow riot.
Before Dow, I went to some, you know, I don't know how consistently and how many, but yeah, there was a buzz on campus, and I know I went to some of them.
And did you resume staying in Ogg Hall that second year, or did you move to somewhere else?
No, I stayed in an apartment with some other guys.
Okay.
I think my roommate that year was Laird Brigad, who became a professor of Latin American history at one of the City of New York colleges.
Okay. Was it this year that you met Jeff, your sophomore year?
Yeah, I believe so, because I think we roomed together my junior year.
Okay. And at this point as a sophomore, are you starting to crystallize what you want to do in terms of a major, or are you still undeclared?
Yeah, I think I had decided on history.
Okay.
I think the Mossy experience really excited my interest in history.
Did you take any classes from Mossy the second year?
No, I kind of transitioned, I think, over to there was a guy named Haupt. I don't remember the exact order, but there was a visiting professor from France who was also a Holocaust survivor named Haupt, and I took a course in French. I believe it was French history with him, which was a fascinating course. I believe he was only there one year. I also began to develop a real interest in African American history, and I took several courses in that. The one I remember the best was with a guy named Robert Starobin, who, you know, actually committed suicide. He was a young faculty member. And then I took at least one course with Harvey Goldberg, maybe two.
How did you, in your mind or upon reflection, how did you compare Mossy and Goldberg? Because they're the two that sort of everybody mentions at that time.
Well, Mossy was more into intellectual history, and Goldberg was, and Mossy was much less flamboyant as a lecturer than Goldberg. Goldberg was really a, you know, flamboyant. It was like going to a performance with Harvey Goldberg. When I think about Goldberg, who I did not have a personal relationship with, I think about the flamboyance and the content, which was much more radical in the sense of, I believe Goldberg was a socialist and was a socialist. Mossi was not. In fact, one of the things I remember about Mossi is that he, during the Black Student Strike, I asked him what he thought. He was disturbed by it, and I was talking, I was youthful and talking to him about, well, this is how history is made, and I remember him telling me, Michael, the masses are asses.
It's a great line.
Yeah, which is probably why it's always stuck with me. I recall him comparing the Black Student Strike and the activity to kind of, I don't know if he called it fascist, but he kind of compared it to right-wing mobilizations that had taken place in Europe. And we disagreed on that.
Right. At least I would assume you disagreed on that.
Yeah.
So just to sort of continue the chronology, Michael, so your junior year is also, at least the spring of your junior year, is when Martin Luther King is assassinated.
Yeah, and I that was a big turning point for me, because when that happened, there was a huge march down State Street, which I joined. And I remember writing a letter to my parents at the time, just telling them that, because back then we wrote handwritten letters, it was time for me to get involved, because I don't remember exactly, but it was very important in terms of motivating me to become an activist.
Okay.
It just seemed to me that with the upbringing that I mentioned, that when there's injustice, you need to not just witness it, but fight against it, which I had learned with a lesson from the family. The assassination of Dr. King was a tipping point for me in terms of you have to become an activist.
Okay. And maybe just it's not necessarily a sidebar, I think it relates. You know, obviously at this time, the Vietnam War is going on.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there was ever a rift between you and your parents on Vietnam.
No, there was not. Because my parents were opposed to the war.
Okay.
My father was, he was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. He fought in World War II. He went to Harvard on the GI Bill, and became a, when the reason we were in New Hampshire was he was a professor at the University of New Hampshire. And he was, you know how they'd have teach-ins at the very beginning of the war?
Mm-hmm.
He would, it's kind of ironic, the two people who debated at the University of New Hampshire were my father and another Jewish faculty member, a historian, Hans Heilbronner. He was pro-war, and my father was the anti-war person.
Hmm.
Which is ironic. I mean, I say it's ironic because there were so many few Jewish people in the community, and even very few on the faculty, and yet it was two of the Jewish faculty members debating.
Right. I said this to Jeff yesterday, that one cannot live on protest alone, and I asked, you know, freshman year places you hung out, did that change at all in your sophomore year when you moved off campus?
Yeah, I don't think I went to the Broad House. I certainly didn't go to the dining area. There was a lot more parties in people's apartments. I don't recall any particularly new commercial venue.
Okay. Was the drinking age 19 at that time?
Yeah, they had 3.2 beer on campus, and I believe the drinking age was 18.
Oh, okay.
Maybe not, because I remember, I'm not sure, because okay. I remember we would talk about we're old enough to fight, but we're not old enough to drink. They may have changed it right in that period.
Okay.
I just don't recall.
Was the consumption of alcohol, was that a thing you did during these first few years?
Yeah, I'd say moderately.
Okay.
That and other, we consumed other things as well.
Well, it is the 60s, so I was assuming that it wasn't just perhaps alcohol being...
you're right about that.
So you say that the turning point was Dr. King's assassination.
Yeah, that's when I said, look, I cannot sit on the sidelines anymore. I've got to get involved. And I think after Dow, which had been in October of that year, right in the fall...
Right, of the academic year, yeah.
Yeah,
so.
SDS kind of got obliterated because the leaders of SDS, I mean, the one I remember is Billy Simon, but a number of them got kicked out, who were upperclassmen, got kicked out of school. And this new group had developed called the Wisconsin Draft Resistance Union. And so I began to go to, to some of their meetings. And it was a different name, but that was kind of the new version, I think, of Students for a Democratic Society.
Okay, so here on our campus, SDS morphed into or sort of transformed into the Draft Resistance Union.
Yeah, that's as I recall it.
Okay, who were, as you started to go to those meetings, who were some of the leaders?
There was a guy named Paul Buell, who became a lecturer at Brown University. I think he's a graduate student. He started a journal called Radical America. There was a guy named John First and his wife Judith Cohen. I'll think of a couple other names in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Swinney was involved in that. Jody Chandler and his wife, whose name escapes me, but they were all, and Bill Drew was involved in that as well.
Okay. Did you, when you attended these meetings, were there things that you were able to volunteer to do to become more active?
Well, I think I was more like, stuffing envelopes, it was low level. I mean, at that point, I didn't consider myself a leader. I considered myself just, hey, I'll help out however I can.
And then that summer, the summer of 68, did you end up going back home or?
No, that summer, okay, so Wisconsin Draft Resistance Union decided that they were going to do like a Vietnam summer modeled on the Mississippi summer. And so I went with Bill Drew to Waukegan, Illinois, where we were going to organize, among working class youth and in the community to kind of spread the anti-war message off campus. Bill Drew was from Waukegan, Illinois. And so I spent the summer there. He was from there, and I think we had an apartment that his parents, I think his father must have owned the building, so we had a rent-free apartment. And we did a lot of organizing, some of it some of it effective and some of it not.
So what sort of things that summer, what would, not that there's really any such thing, but what might constitute a typical day that summer?
Yeah, I don't know what constituted a typical day, but we started working with a lot of younger white youth who were alienated by all kinds of things, by the police harassing them by the lake, by they were worried about the war, you know, and just other things that young guys are worried about. And we started kind of an underground newspaper. I don't remember the name of it. You know, we had something called the Waukegan Movement. And we did organizing around that, mainly around the war and other, I guess, more police kind of harassment issues. And then one of the things that happened is we were trying to pass out our newsletter at a lakefront dance, and turned into a confrontation with the police. They arrested Bill Drew for not, the mayor was a Mayor Sabajian, and he was a real autocrat. They just told the police, they arrested Bill for handing out the flyers, and then I went over to the police car to get his keys, and the police didn't want me to go over to the car, and I said, I gotta get the keys, and next thing I know, I was arrested. So it was kind of a big deal in the town. Ultimately, I think the charges were dropped, but it was something that a lot of the younger people rallied around as well.
So did you spend the evening in jail, or how did that work?
No, we got out.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know how. I don't remember the mechanism of getting out, but I believe his parents helped get us out.
Okay. Anything else from that summer that stands out in your mind?
It was an interesting experience. It was my first experience really organizing, other than, you know, stuff I'd done as in high school, kind of politics. And he and I actually wrote something that Paul Buell published in Radical America about, you know, kind of, it was an article called Beyond Youth Culture, where we kind of said you had to organize beyond just alienation of youth. You had to organize, there had to be content to your organizing, I mean, to try to sum up what we were trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But we did say that our observation was that among working class youth in this country, there was a white working class youth, there was a lot of alienation and fertile ground for organizing.
Did you have any direct involvement or maybe just your thoughts on the 1968 Democratic National Convention?
I did not. Obviously, my friend Billy went down to it, and ironically, he went down to it, somehow got lost in Chicago, and got jumped by some black guys, probably for, you know, not for political reasons. It was kind of an irony. But obviously, everybody was watching it, and I was watching it. I think I had probably... when was that exactly? Because my guess is My guess is I wasn't in Waukegan. My guess is I'd gone back to New Hampshire for a couple of weeks before school started.
Okay. I have the dates as August 26th through 29.
Yeah, that's either that or I was in Madison.
Okay.
Depending on when school started.
Okay. So your memory is you were
memory of it was just as the memory that people who watched it being outraged, being politically outraged, upset about the way people were being treated.
Okay. So, as a young man at that time, seeing what you saw at the Democratic National Convention, I'm assuming also you know, Republicans weren't providing you what you thought you might need.
Right.
What were your political leanings at that point?
I would say, I don't recall if I voted or not. I think I was disgusted with the political system, particularly given what had happened at the Democratic Convention and given that Johnson had been such a strong prosecutor of the war. I remember as a much younger, when I was in high school or even junior high school, being enamored with John F. Kennedy. And but being very upset, as most people were, by the Kennedy assassination. You know, because of Johnson's escalation and commitment to the war in Vietnam, I was politically alienated from both political parties. I mean, I guess that sums it up. So I don't remember. I doubt I voted in 1968.
Okay.
I wasn't eligible anyway. I would only have been.
Oh, that's right. It was still.
I would only have been 20.
Right. You still had to be. You had to be 21.
So I was, you know, not a participant in electoral politics, but I was also highly critical of the Democratic Party.
Okay.
And by then I was very, also because of, you know, the way the Democratic Party handled the attempt by the Mississippi Freedom Democrats to get seated, you know, and I began to have a very strong identification with the civil rights movement, both through courses I took and just because of things I was reading and seeing.
So, one more thing, getting back to Vietnam, how concerned were you, you know, over the course of your young adulthood about being drafted?
Well, I was concerned. I had a number that put me, when they came out with the numbers, and I remember, forget what year that was, but they came out with the numbers. I knew guys who'd gone. I played ball with guys who'd gone from my high school. So when I got my number, I somehow ended up being called up to Milwaukee to take a physical, which I flunked.
What were the grounds of your flunking or failing?
Medical.
Okay.
And, you know, I prepared for that to make sure that I had medical documentation. That was one of the things the Draft Resistance Union did. And I didn't have any qualms about that. I felt I was being patriotic in doing it.
So this brings us now to the fall of 68, so academic year 68-69. At this point, if I remember right from my interview with Jeff, the two of you shared an apartment. And that was not on, but near Mifflin Street?
Not on, it was on Wilson Street.
Okay.
So maybe 4 or 5 blocks away.
One thing I'm interested in, Michael, is before this semester, or before this academic year, did you know of or had made friends with any of the African American students on campus?
Yeah, I knew Willie Edwards. I knew Willie Edwards. And the beginning of my junior year, I began to date an African American woman named Helen Robertson.
Soonish into that fall semester is when the Oshkosh students,
right,
what they call Black Thursday on their
right.
campus. What did you know of that at the time?
Well, I knew about it And I went up there with some of the black students, Willie Edwards, and I don't remember the other, maybe Kenny Williamson. I don't remember if Kenny was involved then or not. But we went up there to try to help build support. It's very vague in my mind, but I remember going up. That's the first time I ever was in Oshkosh. Then what happened is that I had gone to Willie and said we should do something in Madison about this stuff. In fact, I might have said that to him before Oshkosh happened. And he had told, and they had a group at that time called Wapandusi Wayusi, and he had told me that they couldn't do anything until they got themselves organized. So that was kind of the end of it.
Okay.
Then what happened? And so that was the end of it. Then Oshkosh happened, and I don't know if San Francisco State was before Oshkosh. I think it was. And then Oshkosh happened. And then in February, so he had basically said, we can't do anything, so I dropped it, right? So then in February, they used to have something called like a symposium where they'd have a series of speakers in Great Hall. I don't know if they still do it. I don't even remember the theme. It was that's a theme thing, and I don't remember exactly what the theme was, but I know that Nathan Hare from San Francisco State was there. And Nathan Hare met with Willie Edwards and some other leaders and told them, and I remember Willie telling me this, told them that you guys are on a radical campus. We're getting our asses kicked in San Francisco. What the hell are you doing? And I remember that because Willie called me up and said, we're gonna go on strike, and I need you to come to a meeting so we can get the white students involved. And so I went to the meeting. And I believe that meeting was in the, I think they have, they rent apartments, or they did. They rented apartments somewhere in the student union.
Hmm.
And that meeting was in a room, like a hotel room there, I think. I'm not positive, but it was some hotel room. There was a number of, I don't remember if there were any African-American women. I remember a lot, significant number of African-American guys there. And they said, we're going on strike. And, they want me to, they wanted me to make sure to get the white students involved. And I guess the reason that they contacted me was because I knew Willie and because I had raised this issue. I had gone to him earlier in the year and told him, look, we should be doing something around this. And I know people who want to do something around these issues of the lack of black students on campus and, so forth and so on. And so they called me up, and that's how I got into that meeting. And then I remember we called the strike, and the first day of the strike, it was fairly successful on the liberal arts campus in any case. And we had a big rally at Great Hall. And the reason I remember it is because there's a picture of it with me on the stage with a number of the African-American leaders. And the guy who spoke before me gave this great speech about, which he ended, with going, peace, power, liberation, and the place went crazy. I'd never given a public speech in my life. And then I had to get up, and they told me, you have to explain to the white students why they have to support the strike. So rather than just talking about why the demands were just and we should all back it, I gave this very convoluted, horrible, at least in my recollection, speech was very inept. I'll just put it that way. And so I still remember that pretty distinctly.
Yes.
So then I remember that the strike kind of continued for several days, but then as it was winding down, there were 13 demands, and there was some kind of Black United Front that formed. I don't recall the name or that was driving this, but then towards the end, when the strike was petering out, there was an episode where a small handful of protesters knocked over some vending machines and engaged in some kind of petty violence or petty property destruction, I should really say. So that's kind of what those are my most vivid recollections of that strike.
Mm-hmm. So, do you recall being in any of the meetings when the 13 demands were created, or at least...
I don't.
Okay. So I assume while the strike was going on, you did not cross the picket line and attend classes?
Right.
Do you recall how that affected your standing that semester?
What I recall about that semester was that we had that strike, and then about a month later the TAs went on strike, and it became a pass-fail semester, as I recall.
That might be so the Black strike's in 69, the first real big TA strike is in the spring of 70. So it may be back-to-back years, back-to-back spring semesters that you had these major events.
My recollection was always that we didn't go to school, but maybe mm-hmm. I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it affected my grades.
Okay.
I mean, remember, if you miss 10 days, you're missing, three or four classes.
Okay.
And I was a good student. I didn't have any.
Are you taking, as you're an upperclassman, are you taking classes from Mossy and Goldberg, or are there other history professors?
I may have had classes that year with Goldberg, one class with Goldberg, but I don't remember other classes I was taking then. I think I may have been taking many of the Black, more of the African-American history. There was a Black music class that I took probably that year, taught by a African-American jazz musician.
Besides attending that meeting, are there other things that you're willing to talk about that you did to help?
But I just don't remember. I attended that meeting, and I as an attendee, they were basically telling me it wasn't a situation where they wanted my input in terms of demands, or they just wanted me to help them mobilize white students. They were basically telling me, the plan had been developed. They were just saying, okay, now we need you to, you said you'd help on this, now we need you to do that.
Okay.
And I don't remember meetings after that.
Okay.
I just remember, kind of assembling, assembling the strike, and picketing, and rallying on the campus. And I don't remember it in much detail. Oh, I do remember at one point we went, I think, to the. I remember two other things I do recall about it. It was one, there were a number of African American athletes involved in the strike, there were so few African Americans on the campus, but some of the football players were involved. And I remember at one point we went to the basketball arena, not the Kohl Center, but the old basketball arena, to picket a basketball game. This was probably towards the end of a strike, and it's probably a ill-conceived tactic. I remember it wasn't very well responded to by the people going to the game. And I have one friend who was participated in the picket, and then he went into the game, watched the game.
You said there were two other things. Is that that's a combination there?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to continue on, and then I might ask, you know, if there's any other things that pop in your mind specifically about the Black Strike, but you were here. You just alluded to the fact you were here for that last, well, your last academic year, which would then be 69-70.
Yeah.
And particularly, well, not so much maybe the fall of 69, but the spring of 70, there's definitely one of the hotter periods on our campus.
Yeah.
And so first, I mean, there's a lot of things that go on. There's some firebombs, but I'm wondering if you want to, or if you could perhaps start by focusing on the big events, which were March, April, not only the TA strike, but then what led into April and May and Cambodia and Kent State.
Right. And, you know, I would say I was participants in that. I participated. I honored the TA strike. Then there were there were big rallies about the invasions. But I was also getting ready to leave.
Meaning you were ready to get your degree? You were trying to graduate and move on?
Move on. And so I wasn't, I don't think that I was integral to playing a major role in those events. And wasn't it that summer that the Army Math Research Center got bombed?
Yeah, and then August of 70. So then the summer.
No, I was already gone. I as soon as school ended, I moved to Milwaukee.
Okay. Since you mentioned it, though, do you have you weren't on campus when the bomb happened, but your thoughts when you heard about Sterling Hall being bombed?
Well, the thing that struck me the most was that I had brief interactions with two of the people. David Fine had been in during, you know, when earlier we had done dorm organizing against the war. I don't remember what years this was, probably my sophomore and junior years, where we'd gone into the dorms and tried to educate people about the war and went door to door and held dorm meetings and so forth. And I had met David Fine. He hadn't gotten involved or active, but I had met him. And I remember some of us had seen a movie about some activity going on in Wilmington, Delaware. I forget the movie, what it was about, but it was about some progressive organizing in Delaware, and he was in that. We had then met him. And then at one point, probably my junior year, I went to a demonstration in Chicago. And I don't remember if it was a demonstration around racial discrimination, because Fred Hampton, I went to a couple with Fred Hampton, or whether it was against the war. But on the bus that took us, I sat with Leo Burt, who I had never met before. He was a reporter for the Daily Cardinal. And, you know, I rode down with him. I didn't sit with him on the way back. You know, and we kind of chit-chatted. And then, obviously, when that bombing happened, I'm like, wow. You know, and obviously, you know, when the Red Gym was bombed, or, you know, firebombed or whatever it was, I remember, you know, debates about that. Some people wanted to condemn it, and other people saying that I mean, not supporting it, but saying that, you know, getting involved in condemning that, you know, diverts us from opposing the war and the work we should be doing against the war. I was out of Madison when the big bombing took place, so I don't have any real sense. I mean, from reading, I know it had a dramatic effect, but it was like a news story to me.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I was, wow, these two guys I know, or had, you know, I wouldn't say I knew them. I'd say two people that I had passing contact with were accused of participating in it.
Okay, so maybe. Well, let's do this. So you moved to Milwaukee. What were you doing?
I just came to Milwaukee to find a job, and I immediately I think I started working doing non-union construction. You know, I just came up here. I graduated. I had a degree. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I was hired to do, you know, the first job I found was doing some non-union construction.
So for the rest of the time, at least the Vietnam era, you know, the next few years before the war ended and the U.S. pulled out, did you do any other activism?
Yeah, I got involved we helped start a People's Free Health Clinic in Milwaukee, on the west side of Milwaukee, and we did some lead paint screening and some things like that. That was the main activity that I was involved in. And I did the construction, and then I actually got hired at a factory in Lynn Ryerson in the early 70s, where I worked for about. And so I got involved in the union there. This is my first experience with the union.
Yeah, you're known now for your union affiliation. It was interesting that your first job was a non-union construction job.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 60s, the unions, you know, when the unions were not seen necessarily by the you know, kind of anti-war left or the new left as particularly progressive organizations. I actually teach a course now in labor history, and I think that there was kind of a monolithic view of labor, which was, you know, inaccurate. You know, on the other hand, when McGovern ran, and George McGovern, I didn't know this at the time, but George McGovern's dissertation was on the Ludlow Massacre. So here's a guy who clearly, you know, had studied labor and wrote a very sympathetic study of it, and the AFL-CIO didn't support him.
Hmm.
So, you know, the AFL-CIO was, I think, seen by the anti-war movement people at the time as part of the system.
Okay.
And not a force for progress. You know, I mean, I think you can look back and say there was the sleeping car porters. In some cases, in some ways, the UAW, the UE, you know, there were some other unions that were more progressive. It wasn't a monolith, but, you know, for people outside it, when you thought of the AFL-CIO, it clearly was, they were into corporate unionism, and they were not playing a leading role. They were on the cutting edge issues, whether it was civil rights or the war in Vietnam. They supported both.
Okay. Michael, maybe two more things. The first is, and this is a big picture question, I wonder if you've reflected upon what your time in Madison, both academically and as an activist, did for you.
I reflect on it as a great period of my life. It shaped me as who I am, both as a professional and as an activist. And I've remained an activist my entire life, committed to the ideals of social justice and equality. I think those are American ideals. And I think that what I learned in Madison, both in the classroom and also on the picket lines, helped me. It turned me into an organizer because I learned how to organize students, and I've used that. I've been the president of the union here for 14 years.
Michael, anything that comes to mind from specifically this time period in Madison or the Vietnam era that you feel it important to get into this oral history?
The only other thing I'd say is, since I mentioned that, you know, I avoided the draft, is that in the early 70s, I worked very closely with the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, which was also, I think in 1969 was the year they threw their medals back. And when I moved to Milwaukee, I got very involved with that organization. Because I thought it was an important organization, because, as I said, I thought opposition to the war was patriotic, and that they were an organization that, even though I wasn't a veteran, that was an organization that was playing an important role in building anti-war sentiment. And, you know, I made a number of lifelong friends during that period.
So, Michael, I'm going to close down the recording here, and then if you don't mind, we chat for a minute.
I gotta get to.
Okay. If you'll at least give me a second after I shut off the recorder. So this concludes the oral history with Michael Rosen. Michael, thank you for your time.
Thank you.